Hey everyone, as promised, we bring you the second and final part of our conversation with Harry Bissell. If you haven't listened to the first part, I highly recommend listening to part one first. So yeah, please go back and listen to that. On today's episode, we talk more about Harry being an interpreter for a professional Japanese football club, but we also go off on a bit of a tangent and touch on Harry's foray into his amateur mixed martial arts and boxing fights he's had in Japan. Yeah, really interesting stuff there. If you'd like to support the podcast, please leave us a donation by clicking on the link in the description notes, and that would be much appreciated. All right, on with the show.
1, 2, 3.
So you, obviously you've traveled all over Japan to watch teams. So you've met pretty much what all of the league players, right? Like all the J1 players from the opposition teams as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So you obviously met like Iniesta and who else? Who else?
Podolski, David Villa.
Is Torres here?
Torres, yeah. I've got Torres' jersey actually.
Yeah, right. So you obviously met them and...
Torres is a real nice bloke actually. I was quite surprised. His English is really good as well. After we played them, I went down to the away dressing room with Jay and we had a little chat with him just about life in Japan, and he's talking about his kids and everything, and yeah, top guy. And that's a nice, you know, shirt from my collection.
Yeah,
a World Cup winner. Brilliant.
Man, awesome. Who would you say is the nicest football player you've met, or the guy you thought, oh, he's a real cool dude, or someone you got on the best with, or something like that?
I suppose, you know, the one that I know best is Jay.
Yeah, of course.
Over the last few years, we've developed a really good, you know, working relationship and become really good friends as well. You know, got to know him really well, and he's had a son since I've known him, and you know, his son's just starting to talk and say my name. So I'm really close with Jay, obviously. But apart from that, yeah, there's a couple of the lads at the club I'm good friends with. The goalkeeper, Son Yoon, he's a cool guy, and Shinji I knew from before I started working at the team, and his English is good, having played in Australia. And that is one of the most humblest guys that I've met. He's, you know, he's a legend here. He's like Japan's David Beckham, but he's so grounded, so down to earth. He's a great guy.
Yeah, how old is he now?
He's turning 40 this year.
Okay. I think there are a couple foreign players on the team, or is Jay the only one right now?
We've got Jay. We've got two Brazilians,
yeah.
Lopez, Lucas, so, two Koreans, Son Yoon and Minte, and a Thai guy called Chanatip, who's a great lad as well and a really good player.
Yeah, so are there interpreters for all of them as well, or how does that work?
Yeah, the two Koreans, they've been here since they were, I think, 17, 18, so they're fluent in Japanese. They could be interpreters themselves, so they don't have one. There's a Thai interpreter for Chanatip, and there's a Brazilian interpreter who speaks Portuguese, and he's been doing this job for, I think, 20 years now. He's been at Consulate the whole time, so he's been, you know, really good for me as well to learn from, and he's got so much experience, giving me a lot of good advice. And the manager is from Yugoslavia, but he speaks German, so he's got an interpreter as well. So I think there's what, me, T, Uri, Daisuke, there's four of us there.
Do you interpreters like hang out like after hours and talk about strategies and stuff like that?
Yeah. No, we just normally moan about the players in terrible. Yeah.
I have a question about, during a match game, so where are you positioned during a match? Are you like on the subs bench? Are you next to the coach?
It depends. So last season and the season before that, I was on the bench because we didn't have a Brazilian in the team. But now we've got two Brazilians in the team. So I think the way that they've looked at it this season is two Brazilians, one English player. We need the Brazilian interpreter on the bench more. So, you know, I stand next to the dugout basically. But, you know, the last couple of years I was on the bench, and that was a pretty cool experience as well.
So you're always like pitch side. Pretty much.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So what during games, what are the subs like talking about? Are they like all watching the game? And
they're good. A lot of the time they're yelling as much as the coaches from the bench, you know, come on, do this, do that. Or that was good. You know, they're encouraging their teammates.
And obviously you are as well, like during the whole game.
You're Actually, I was surprised when I first started this job, because I'm not running around like the players, but you're so involved in the game. It's a different level than being a spectator. You know, I'm shouting advice, and you're so emotionally attached to the players as well. And of course, it's your job. You want the team to win at a completely different level as you do as a supporter, and the adrenaline rush that you're on. You know, when the game's finished, you're like, man, I'm knackered. You know, the wife takes me home and she's trying to talk to me.
You're almost like a player, basically. You just don't play.
I think, right? It's the closest thing you can be to a player without playing.
That's what I was, something I was kind of wondering about too. I mean, did you feel like your lifestyle had to change a lot after you started working with the team? Like, and did that obviously bring some strains, to your personal life as well? Or
it was a massive change, you know, a huge shift of gears to the lifestyle that I was living. You know, the intensity was the thing that really, you know, struck me first, because, you know, I was just kind of going through the gears as an English teacher, and then I got thrust into this different world. And yeah, the intensity was different, but, you know, I got used to that. But then when you get used to that, it's a lot of traveling you have to get used to as well. But I think it's like anything else. If you enjoy it, you know, and if you love it, then you push through that and you get used to it. If you can embrace it, then you get over it. And it took me half a season, but I'm fine with it now. But it was a big change.
Are you staying in like real nice hotels all the time when they're on like away games?
On the most part, yeah. there's some places that you go and there isn't a nice hotel in that city. I'm not going to say where, so I don't want to slag anybody off. But sometimes we get there and I'm like, oh.
And it's good because you get to explore the cities as well, because after when you're not playing, you guys probably go out, explore the city,
go to some
special places.
And for the players, say, the day before the game, or even the day of the game, if it's a 7 o'clock kickoff, 8 o'clock kickoff, then there's nothing to do all day. A lot of the players will sleep, but I'm not going to play football for 90 minutes in front of all those people. So I don't really need the rest. I'll go out and explore the city. And it's one of the good things about this job. I've been all over the place. I've seen all the different cities and, you know, ate all the different food and put on a bunch of weight. It's been good.
Yeah, like part of that as well. I mean, have you gone out and just been in places or enjoying places that you were like, man, I can't believe I'm sitting here right now and this is happening, like the people around me and stuff? Like,
oh, yeah, 100%.
Going to clubs or something or anything like that?
The one that stands out the most would have been, I went back to England for the first time in 4 years, I think, pre-season. And Jay was in London. He said, oh, you know, come down and see me. I was like, yeah, of course. So I went down to London on the train, and I got to his. He said, oh, we're going out. So I thought, oh, yeah, brilliant. And he's told me all these stories about London and how good it is. And I was like, yeah, I've been to London. I didn't have a clue. We went to this club in London, and it was like something off a movie, you know. Pull up. He's got a nice car in London too. He had his mate drive us down there, pull up outside, and, you know, bouncers there. Obviously, got this big building with these big pillars. And you go in, and it's this massive, great big place. And we walked kind of straight through it. And I was like, what are we doing, man? This place is kicking. Why don't we go to the bar? And then in front of us is a tiny little stairway. And we walked down there, and there was this really low door, like, low enough, I'm like 5'8" maybe at push, and I would have to like duck to get in there. There's a big guy standing in front of it. He's like, oh, hello, Jay. He says, I mean, I don't even know if I want to say how much it was for per person to go in there, but it was a lot. And Jay's like, yeah, no worries. I'm sure I'll make a good time. So we go in there, and you go, this tiny little door is like something off Alice in Wonderland, and it just opens up like this. It's massive, all chandeliers and, you know, the decor and everything. I've never seen anything like it in my life. Really, you know, the lighting was dim, but it was just, you know, it was classy. And when you see the people in there, I'm like, man, all these people must be famous, because I don't know how much it has to get in there. But you know, when you see someone and they just have an aura about them, they're dressed in a certain way, that's not an average person. You just kind of have a sense. I was like, man, I wish I could like recognize who these people are. Like, not that I could approach them, but yeah, we spent a good night in there. It was a lot of fun. And then after we came out, obviously we went home, but I Googled the place the next day. There's no pictures of that bar on Google at all. There's no images of that bar that we went into at all. But there are images of people coming out of it. The paparazzi have talked.
So it's a proper VIP place.
I was looking at it and I seen, you know, Rihanna and Red Hot Chili Peppers and who's some rapper, I can't, Drake. Drake had been in there, and I was like, damn, I know that this level of person was in there while I'm just not down with the kids. I don't know if he's famous anymore. Man, but yeah,
it was. That you say that happens in London. Does that happen in Sapporo? Because I know like the nightlife in Sapporo is not really kicking. Like, you know, there's no real glamorous nightclubs. Yeah,
I thought, you know, having worked in bars in this city, I thought I got a decent idea of what's going on here nightlife wise. But there's always a level up. I've been to some places here, real nice places that I would never have dreamt to go, you know, on my own. I wouldn't even know they existed. But, you know, of the world of professional sports, they need these places to go to so they don't get harassed or they don't get judged on going out, because, you know, a lot of people would begrudge them of that because they're professional athletes, but they're just people too. They want to go out and have a good time, and, you know, to do that in society now where they will get judged like that, they have to have these places, and there are special places that cater to them, and they're amazing.
Yeah, so similar to like what you can get in London, like, or hidden at least.
Yeah, not quite similar to what I saw in London.
Especially not in Sapporo, maybe Tokyo.
I've been to some nice places in Tokyo too.
Well, one thing I wanted to ask about, because it kind of came up when you were saying, like, sometimes you have to kind of look out for the players when they're out or something. Just regular people around maybe doing something that's not too acceptable. But I wanted to get into that a little bit, because you do have an interesting background as well for some training, physical training, fight training and stuff. And one thing that's really interesting, obviously, because Ben and I both train some martial arts as well, but you've had some, are they amateur or are they considered pro fights in Sapporo?
I would say they're amateur, but, you know, if you win, you get paid.
yeah. So it's kind of like quasi-pro fights or something. Yeah.
And two of the guys that I faced did actually turn pro. And they're, you know, they're making a go at it now and doing pretty well, so I'm happy for them.
Yeah, so can you tell us a little bit about that? Like, how did, did you have, like, a long background in combat training, or did you have a background? And then how did that whole thing start to kind of develop for you here in Sapporo?
Yeah, I always loved combat sports, you know, especially boxing. And, you know, I've done a little bit of boxing in the past, but nothing serious. And, you know, as you get older, you drift away from some things, as, you know, you get swept away with life and responsibilities. And I dropped a lot of it. But then, you know, I found I had some free time on my hands. And I got to 30 and, you know, I thought I'll pick it up again. And there's a good scene, as you and Ben know, there's a good scene here in Sapporo. A lot of, you know, people interested in MMA, kickboxing, jiu-jitsu. And I thought, you know, I'm going to start back up again. And, you know, it turned into a passion. And I got really into mixed martial arts. I started training a lot of jiu-jitsu, you know, got into kickboxing. And you know, it kind of blew my mind having, you know, solely only considered boxing in the past, how much more potential the human body has. To inflict pain on another human.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. Like, a lot of people don't really... It's not just that, though. Like, you start to train and then you kind of, when you train it as a kid, you're just thinking about, you know, you want to have some skills or be, tough and everything. But when you kind of start training these things as an adult, like you kind of start to realize that more mental side of it and how it just like benefit as a person and growing it and stuff.
And that's one thing that I think I underestimated when I got into it. You know, I never got into it to have fights, you know, to get in the ring and have a fight. I wasn't really thinking about that at the start, you know. I just enjoyed it and it was good. I was getting fit. But then, you know, as you get better at it, you want to test yourself. And, I have that in me. I'm kind of a naturally competitive person. I always played football. You know, I had a little go at rugby and I've always enjoyed sports. And when I started and, you know, I was sparring in training and I was getting better at it. You know, I was full of confidence and I wanted to test myself. And I had those fights, but I didn't expect the impact that it had in terms of the confidence and the things that I could take from it that have, you know, carried over into my life as it is now in this world of professional sports where, you have to be confident. You have to hold yourself in a way that I don't think I would have been able to do if it weren't for my training, you know, the discipline and everything that comes with training martial arts as well as the confidence.
Yeah, so in the end, how many fights did you have? Three, was it? Or
I had two MMA fights and one boxing fight.
Two MMA fights and one boxing fight. And that must have been pretty crazy. Like, how exactly was that set up? Did somebody kind of, cause you were, I guess, training at some of the local gyms and stuff. And obviously for people that don't know, all sorts of people train at the local gyms, people that are members of different gyms, people that are members of fight teams and stuff. So when an event is starting to get put together, maybe people just get approached. And then especially because, there's obviously not a huge foreign population in Sapporo. They might want some foreigners on the card and stuff. Did you actively seek that out or did somebody kind of approach you about it or?
Yeah. What started to happen was, you know, we do a lot of sparring and like you say, there's a lot of people from different gyms, you know, and everybody mingles and we all spar against each other. And, you know, I started to do quite well against people. It was, you know, getting kind of handy and people was like, oh, you should fight. And I was like, you know what? I don't know. But then the more people said it and the better that I got, I thought, yeah, man, why not? Let's just give this a go. Like, you know, what's the worst that can happen? and yeah, it just kind of happened in a way. People, because before people say you should fight, I go, nah, I'm not interested. I'm just doing this just to get in shape. I'm enjoying it, you know, but I don't think I'm going to fight. And then I think one day someone says, you know, you should fight. There's an event coming up. And I kind of went, yeah, maybe. And then I got a call the next day from the promoter and he says, ah, oh, I heard you want to fight. I was like, you know, yeah, all right, why not? And he said, okay, cool, we've got an opponent for you. I said, how do you have an opponent for me already? I just said yes. So then, you know, I phoned my friend who I started training here with called Johnny, you know, and I said, hey, I'm going to fight. He's like, oh, yeah, nice one. So I'll see you tomorrow then. And then we just ramped up training, and I think I had 4 weeks before the fight then. Yeah.
4 weeks. So you only started training seriously like for that fight four weeks before the fight.
4 weeks prior. Yeah. And
it was just kind of like casual, like
just
a few times a week.
Just twice a week, three times a week sometimes. But the other thing about that was the weight limit was 62.8 kilograms.
how much do you weigh now?
Now I don't know, it's like 77.
Wink, wink.
conservative estimate.
So at that time?
At that time, I was probably 70. And, I did a proper weight cut and it was excruciating.
I remember seeing you like the day of the fight. And you looked ripped, but I'd never seen you that skinny before.
Yeah. I did a lot of, for like 4 years prior, I mean, I was training a lot and I was really into, you know, UFC and MMA and everything. So I knew a little bit about weight cutting but before that fight, I really researched it, and I did a full-on weight cut.
Wait, so that was your first weight cut you had ever done, and it was like 8 kilos or something?
Yeah, man.
Oh my gosh, man. Brutal. Like, I used to cut weight, obviously, because I wrestled in high school. And I think the most I cut, I mean, it was in pounds, but it was like probably 17 pounds over, like, but I mean, I was used to it, you know, and we were doing that sometimes, like, every week we'd have to cut sometimes, you know, between 10 and 50 pounds or something, but like, never having done it before, and you say,
yeah,
like,
I am my first time,
and you're just researching it, and like,
yeah, I just researched it on my own, and I can't remember, you know, exactly how I did it now, but I knew that, you know, I'd done a water load first, and I was drinking a lot of water all the time, so I knew that my body would, you know, sweat when I, even when I was dehydrated. And I remember the day before the weigh-in, I was full, you know, plastic boiler suit kind of thing, doing rounds on the pads. And it was like, you know, you see on the films, you pull the sleeve out and the sweat just pours out.
Pouring out, yeah.
And then I got in a hot bath and then laid down with towels and sweated it all out.
Was somebody helping you get through the cut? Was Johnny helping you, or are you just doing
No, John. In fact, I don't know if I want to say this. the day before the weigh-in, Johnny says, yeah, I don't know if I'm going to come to training tonight.
Like, dude, I'm at
bro,
the end of my
you
cut.
Know what I'm preparing to do. But no, he came in the end. I don't know if he was just winding me off.
You're like at the end of your cut and everything?
But yeah. No, after that, obviously, I trained and done that cut in the plastic suit. Then I went home on my own and sweated it out in the bath with the towels. My wife's like, what are you doing?
Was it day before weigh-in or
day before the weigh-in? Yeah, and then... The weigh-in, obviously, I got there as early as I could. Yeah.
So straight after the weigh-in, it was like the weigh-in was the day before the fight.
Day before
is that right?
The fight.
So
yeah.
When it came to like fight day, how much did you like put back on?
Yeah, I weighed in at 62.8, and then I can't remember. I think I put on like 4, 5, something like that.
Man,
yeah, just by rehydrating.
Yeah, that's crazy.
But I remember in the fight, it was weird. Because I came out and we had this kind of like, they changed the opponent on me, like, you know, a couple of days before as well. So I wasn't really ready for this, like, really like kind of tall and skinny grappler coming at me. And he was coming at me and like falling on the floor and using butterfly hooks and taking me down in ways that I'd never seen. And I remember like 10 seconds in, I was like, my God, I'm knackered. Like, what is this? You're not, I wasn't prepared for, I think, the adrenaline rush as well. When you get in there and the lights are on you and, you know, everybody's watching, just that your heart going faster as well kind of tires you out. I wasn't ready for that either, but it's a gnarly experience.
Yeah.
I remember he tried to take me down, and the first thing, he pulled guard on me and got me in a triangle. I was like, no, because I kept getting caught in triangles in training all the time. I can't believe someone's told him about this. Like, so he knows how to beat me. This is a stitch up. But I remember, like, I just picked him up and just swung him. I kind of threw him off. I just, like, strengthed my way out of it. And then I was like, man, I'm so knackered. And then he tried to take me down again, like he pulled guard on me again. And I remember I was just wailing on his head. I was like stomping him, like boom, boom, boom. And he wasn't hurting. I was like, man, I've got no strength. This is horrible. But I was hitting him, and I could hear someone like going, ah, in the crowd. And I looked back and I swear it was his mum. It was a crazy experience. But
man, I remember that fight. It was like, favors. It's the first, I guess, live fight I've ever seen, like MMA fight, and like so many of your friends were there.
Yeah,
and you just had like,
it was good fight.
Image, half the stadium, I think, half the arena was like supporting you.
Yeah.
So when you came out, man, and like everyone stood up.
I was
like,
so confident reading into that fight. I told everybody to come. Everybody's got to come, man. And everybody did come. Yeah. I was so pumped, man. I was so glad to see everybody. So much support. And it was funny because, I mean, obviously there's guys way tougher than me in town. They've got black belts here, and, you know, you guys tap me out all the time. But I don't think anyone else had got in the ring, and now I kind of understand why.
Yeah,
but at the time, it was, you know, it was cool, man.
Man, and you did it twice. So like
three times.
Three times.
Yeah.
Right. So did that weight cut obviously get easier?
I think the weight cut did get easier, but the one thing that I really, you know, can appreciate about, you know, professional fighters now is doing that weight cut and maintaining the strength to go through, you know, sometimes a 5-round fight. I think it's just incredible, because I really did notice, and in all three fights, there was times when I hit my guy with a punch that I know would drop a guy, but I just didn't have the strength because I obviously didn't have the experience of weight cutting. I made weight, which I was proud of, but I think there's obviously a better way to do it where you don't lose so much of your strength.
Do you think you could just like not cut weight and just go in as what you weigh as? Because then you'd have your power.
I would like that to be the case in professional fight sports too, not just MMA, but boxing and wrestling and right across the board. Because having done it myself and, you know, having researched it quite a bit and followed fight sports a lot, I don't think it's safe. I don't think people die. When you dehydrate, you lose the fluid around your brain as well. And it you know, I think it's dangerous, but you're kind of forced to do it. I didn't really want to do it. I mean, I kind of did because I like to gain that kind of appreciation for a sport that, you know, I'm kind of passionate about. But I don't think it's a good thing, but you have to do it because you know your opponent is.
Yeah, like obviously I've never done any MMA fights or anything, but just from wrestling, like no matter, I mean, even now in the like UFC and other things, we see people having a lot more success when they stop cutting weight. So there's a strong argument to do it, but there's that whole mental and psychological thing that at the end of the day, you're thinking like, if I don't cut weight, then I'm competing against guys that are basically two weight classes above me. And at the end of the day, actually, you're probably going to be at your best if you're not cutting weight, but you still have that in your head like, oh.
You're going to be fighting a guy that's much bigger.
Yeah,
because they're cutting the weight too.
Exactly. Yeah. And they're going to put it back on, just like you said.
Yeah.
But, you know, what's their true condition or not? So I like what some of those professional leagues are doing. Is it one or one of the leagues
one,
is
one
like, yeah, they basically banned it. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. So I think that's could be a really good future for MMA and everything. But, yeah, so also apart from the MMA, man, I think you have some other things going on. You're a really good artist. I see you posting some stuff for players and stuff. Are you doing that out of hobby? Or?
When I was in England, I was a graphic designer before I got made redundant, which led me to come in here. But yeah, I was a professional graphic designer. We did a lot of, you know, decently big clients, National Lottery, Levi's, you know, places like that. So I had experience of doing that anyway. I was a major of graphic design in college. So I always enjoyed art. And now I do it kind of as a hobby. When I was, you know, involved in fighting, cornering fighters, we would make T-shirts for them. And, you know, people would, I would just give them away, you know. People would wear them to fights and it was good fun. But now I draw.
So now I remember you telling me you got some projects that you're working on, some drawing projects for the football team.
Yeah, I just set myself like kind of a little challenge because I noticed I was getting carried away with work. You know, it's a 24/7 job, really. You know, if his internet goes down, I could get a call at 11 o'clock tonight and he's like, hey, my internet's not working. You know, I have to sort that out. But I noticed I wasn't drawing, so I set myself a challenge. I want to draw every single player in the squad, like a kind of a portrait of them playing football. So I've got to do that before the end of the season.
Yeah, like that stuff, like if the internet goes down and you get a call or something like that, is that actually part of the contract or is that just like you just feel, I mean, that's a kind of unwritten part of the job that everyone's got
to
do?
The interpreter's job is to do everything for the player that the player can't do himself because of his lack of Japanese ability. So anything like that, yeah.
Make his life as easy as possible.
Yeah.
And also like you're kind of your mates, right? So it's almost like if I have a problem, I might call one of you two to help me out if I got a problem with something.
Yeah.
Like, you know, my Japanese level is not very good, so yeah. I might call up Burke and say, what does this bill say? Something like that. So
definitely.
Maybe something like that.
There's some things that if he wasn't a mate, I would be like, I'm not dealing with that now. I'm in bed. Leave me alone.
Like when you first came here, you know, you were kind of saying like you didn't want to get into the English teaching and stuff, and I think you were kind of also saying like in Sapporo people do tend to feel limited a little bit in what they can pursue and stuff, but kind of seeing where you've come to now and some of these other things that you're always getting started and getting involved with, do you think Sapporo is kind of a city that there is actually opportunity there if people try to pursue other interests, or do you think like it still feels a little bit limited to you?
I would say that it's like anywhere else in the world, that if you're prepared to go out and try new things, if you're open enough to speak to different people and, you know, to maintain good relationships with people, then, you know, you can pretty much do whatever you want, you know, within reason. You know, you can go on and do all kinds of things. I know all kinds of people here that don't teach English, you know, magicians, fighters, you know, me, I'm an interpreter. You can do whatever you want, but you have to be open. I think a lot of people that come here, you know, they've married a Japanese woman and they don't speak Japanese. They let their wife do things for them. Their only friends are foreigners. Their only hobby is drinking. And that's not the fault of where they are. That's a closed mindset. And I think that if you are going to come to Sapporo or, you know, anywhere, then you have to get immersed in the culture of that city. You have to find your niche. And the only way to do that is by getting involved with things. And look, if you're going to live in a country, learn the language for sure.
Yeah, put yourself out there. Yeah. Take risks.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you're going to be in Japan long term? Or do you feel sometimes, you know, the urge to move back home? Or do you kind of feel like now you've put in so much time to live in Japan that you're here long term?
I mean, when I came here, I was committed to making it work because I don't want to be the person that said he was moving and then, you know, failed and ran back home. So, you know, I came out here and I was committed and now I've bought a house. So, you know, I've got to pay my mortgage off somehow. So, you know, I'm here till I'm 55 at least. But no, in all seriousness, you know, I like it here. I love the lifestyle, you know, and I feel, you know, at this current moment in time, I'm making a good go of it. So I'm quite optimistic about the future. And I do believe that I'll stay here for a long term. You know, maybe life will take me to Tokyo or another city. But, you know, at the moment, I'm committed. I want to stay and work for Sapporo as long as I can.
Do you have any, like, future plans or future goals that you're aiming for at the moment?
I'm going to start doing my coaching licenses. So I'll do my C license first. So, yeah, maybe I'll get my coaching licenses and see what happens. But at the moment, I just want to, you know, keep working for the team and hope that the team does well.
To stay in football and stay with Consadole.
Absolutely.
Do you feel like you're a foreigner living in Japan, or do you feel like, I mean, obviously maybe you don't feel like you're a Japanese person, I don't think any of us do, or do you feel like you're kind of in kind of a different world, obviously, because you're doing something very, very unique and stuff? I mean, do you feel some of these frustrations as a foreigner living here, or do you just feel like you're so busy with what's going on with this job that you're not really affected or you don't get fazed by stuff like that?
I think when I was an English teacher, you're kind of looked at as, you know, a foreigner because you're doing a job that only foreigners can do. You know, there's no real Japanese people going and teaching English the way that the foreigners do. I think that since I got this job, I've, you know, treated a little bit differently than I was before. So I do feel, you know, less of a foreigner because I'm so much involved in this one thing. And it's kind of a big thing for the city, really. The football team is, you know, represents the city. So you kind of feel that responsibility as well. And people treat you in a way that is, you know, really welcoming. They support you, you know, they support the team. So I feel that support from them. So I do, obviously, I'm a foreigner. I feel like a foreigner, but day in, day out, I'm speaking, you know, unless I'm speaking to Jay, I'm speaking Japanese. So I don't feel like the outsider that I have done in the past. Yeah, I mean, that's been a change.
So, like, what is, you know, there's other interpreters in the team. What is kind of their relationship with, you know, the staff and the team? Is it like three separate groups, or are you considered, like, the players? Or would you say the staff?
No, we're very much staff.
Yeah,
the staff really see us as staff. But the players, I think they have a different relationship with us because they know how much we know. And they're, you know, they're a little bit more open with us than they are with the coaches. And I think with me as well, being a foreigner, they can be a little bit more relaxed with me. You know, it's not all this and mass, and they don't have to, you know, watch their P's and Q's when they talk to me. So, you know, it's a different kind of relationship. But the translators are very much staff.
Yeah.
Do you feel like, because I've been working in a Japanese company or in corporate world now, I guess, probably for 12 years. Depending on the company, like, especially if you're like what's called Seishin at a company, you're considered like a permanent worker. And like Seishin, if for Japanese people, I mean, you're kind of joining a organization, and the organization is kind of there to look out for you. Whereas in the US, working in the corporate world, you kind of feel like you can move to the next company at any time. So there's not really that same type of, I guess, bond or like commitment, two-way commitment. And that works good and bad, because sometimes they'll expect a lot of you or behave a certain way because you are part of that organization, as they say. And that's why, like, if people get in trouble, have legal problems in Japan or something, then it's really bad for the company and the organization and stuff. Is it that same way working for Consadole? Like, are you kind of part of that organization? Or, because, you know, like, I guess players get transferred around a lot and stuff. Or, I mean, they feel, are you a part of the league, or are you part of the organization, or what's the feeling in that sense?
Yeah, I'm employed by Consadole, so, you know, I'm their employee, basically. The difference between Japan and European teams is that even if the manager changes, the staff stay the same. So the manager changed, but the coaches are the same. That's why the Brazilian interpreter has been there for 20 seasons. Yeah. So, you know, my job is stable. But at the same time, even more so than I think a normal team, if you do anything wrong and someone sees it, then it's more of a big deal. You have to kind of, you know, I won't even cross on a red man anymore.
You know what I mean? Really?
I kind of feel like I have to kind of watch myself in that kind of way now, because I don't know who's looking. And you have to kind of obey the rules more. You have to be a little bit more responsible.
Because I remember when you first started your job, you kind of cut down on drinking a lot, so, or going out anyway, right? Like nights out.
Yeah.
Is that still the case now? Have you kind of...
A lot of that was...
A bit more relaxed now about it.
I really wasn't... You know, it's the same with anything. When your life shifts gears like that, you have to be really focused, I think. And I kind of recognized that I really needed to be switched on the whole time. And as I've got used to the job and I've got, you know, into the routine, I know what to expect tomorrow now. You know, something might come up, you know, a lot of times something does come up, but I know what to expect. So I can, you know, I can go out and have a couple of beers on a night and not worry, you know. But
you don't want to be hungover at work, right?
No, I couldn't, because it, you know, you got to be switched on. You have to be switched on. And yeah, but, you know, now I can go out and have a couple of beers because I know what to expect the next day. But when I started, I had to be 100% focused. And it was kind of tough in a way, because I didn't see my friends for, man, I think I took basically a year off of socializing.
Yeah, I didn't see you for probably about that long.
Yeah. But, you know, now I'm starting to get back to, you know, I'm starting to train jiu-jitsu again. But, you know, went back after a year and a half and broke a rib.
See you in another year.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. That's a kind of a false start.
Yeah, well, that's kind of one thing you were talking about, is like just that intensity when you first got exposed to it. I mean, is that still kind of something that, I mean, I guess now you're more used to it now, but I guess, are those guys just like, obviously they're taking their like career, obviously much more seriously than just people that are going out and doing it as a hobby. I mean, is there very much a difference in how those guys are approaching their sport and everything? And just,
yeah, 100%. They have to be disciplined the whole time. You know, they have to mind what they eat. They, you know, whatever they put in their body, they have to think about it real carefully, because, you know, it affects them, you know, in the next day in training. And they have to be good in training. If you're not good in training, you don't play. And if you don't play, you might be on less money next season. So they have to, you know, be switched on the whole time.
Yeah, do they have somebody who's kind of planning and I mean, actually, do they have an off season where like maybe they'll get out of shape a little bit, or is it year round? Or
yeah, we have, I think the middle of December we're off, and we're off until the middle of January, so it's like a month off. That's it. Yeah, we get a month off, and that's it.
But they get Christmas and New Year off.
Yeah. Christmas and New Year, and then it's back, and then we after that we do a 3-month camp, so we're away from home. Like my first camp, we went to Hawaii, Okinawa, Kumamoto.
Nice.
And then last season we went to Thailand. We went to Chiang Mai, Bangkok, and then Okinawa and Kumamoto.
Is this training, or is this
training
and playing games as well with like the local teams?
Yeah, when we went to Hawaii, we played in a tournament. We played against a bunch of MLS teams, so it's a couple of friendlies, couple of tournament games.
So you're kind of doing like what all the big kind of European teams do as well. They do go on like tours of America or Asia and stuff like that.
And we did the same thing in Thailand as well. We played a bunch of Thai teams.
Yeah.
We whooped them all.
Yeah, it was like, was your wife cool with all that also? I mean, maybe she was just supportive of you getting like this great opportunity and the job and everything. But are you away from home sometimes for an extended period for some of these like...
Yeah. I mean, I'm away from home probably 2-3 times a month for a couple of days at a time. And then obviously when we're in camp, I'm gone for 3 months. I probably get home for 2 days in those 3 months. And it's winter as well, so it's difficult because, you know, she has to shovel all the snow out of the way of the house and take the dog out in the morning and at night. And it's tough for her, but she's been really supportive because, you know, it is a good opportunity. It's not something that a lot of people get the chance to do, and who knows where it will lead. So, you know, she's been good. She's knuckled down.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you got some more things you want to get covered here?
I think we're pretty good. We're about that time. Covered a lot of things. Any last things you want to say, Harry?
No, guys.
Yeah. Your social media, you want anyone to follow you or anything?
I'm good. Follow these guys on Instagram.
Yeah, Voices in Japan, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, voiceinjapan@gmail.com. And if you want to support us as well, you can leave a donation. You can find the link in the description. Yeah, feel free to do that.
Yeah, man, just want to say thanks for coming on, because again, this is something that, you know, we obviously don't know anybody else is doing, and I think it's really interesting for people overseas to hear about this, and for even people living in Japan, man. It's a really unique situation you've been able to build for yourself. So thank you so much for coming on and sharing.
Thanks for having me on, guys, and I'll do whatever I can to support your podcast. I think it's excellent. Keep going.
Thanks, man. Appreciate that. All right. See everyone again next time. Bye.